All of the views and opinions expressed here are those of the individual speaking and may not be representative of Coding American. At times, language may be considered vulgar. Listener discretion is suggested.
You are now listening to the Coding Behind the Wheel podcast.
Okay, we're live. I'm Scott from Koenig, and with me is Joey Redman. Joey's the founder of Rec Magazine. He's been published in countless times in your favorite automotive magazines. But most importantly, Joey's been involved with drifting since the first years here in the States. And he writes the 10 Things Learned article that is published on formuladrift.com after each event. Joey and I get together after every FD event. We do some recapping. We throw down some random drift thoughts. But most importantly, we recap his 10 points from each event. So we're here. We're going to do Orlando today. We just finished good old Orlando at OSW. And I want to jump right into point 10. But before we get there, I think I'm going to add my own point in and go to a point 11. What do you think about that?
Let's do it. All right. What is your so important 11?
First off, it's extremely important. And it's a shameless plug. Reader and Napoleon Motorsports, they didn't make it again. They have that electric Camaro. We know about the drama that we had from them coming out of Long Beach. They didn't get to run the car. The car was seen in practice drifting. There's video of that. The car kind of looked good from the video that we saw. And it never made it to the track. So that's, I guess now we're at that point where we're going to see what happens in Atlanta, and hopefully whatever the issues were that plagued the car in practice where they decided to scrap that they kind of get it together and were able to get it resolved, and maybe we'll see this car actually come out fighting in Atlanta.
So you don't know what happened?
So I've heard some things. I would like you to unbiasedly tell me what those things are.
I honestly haven't heard anything, so... I didn't say anything, kind of. But how about this? I saw the video of the run.
Right.
I wasn't underwhelmed. I wasn't overwhelmed. Like, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Do I think he would have finished better in the Camaro than the 240? Probably not.
From what I can see, it looked like it. There's parts of these videos all the way around. I mean, a lot of it you can tell where shakedown passes. Clearly, the car drifts. Clearly, it can initiate. Clearly, it looks decent. It makes the power and torque that's needed to make it through. So we now have video proof that anybody who was saying before that, they didn't get it, we know that the car is driftable. We know that this is a potential. Whatever the issue was that were plaguing them, we might be able to kind of get that directly from Travis Reeder. We're hoping to... hopefully sometime before Atlanta, we are potentially going to grab him for a podcast. So we'll see how that goes. And maybe that will be a question we'll be able to put a really solid answer on. But anyhow, so my appointment number 11, hopefully we see them in Atlanta.
Now, you're 100% sure that it was the team decision not to run the car?
That's a great question.
Okay.
And I believe the answer is no, I'm not 100%. From what I've heard, and I have no access, I have not really had a good chance. I mean, a few messages back and forth to Travis, but I really didn't even get into that. One, because I hope that we can grab on the podcast before Atlanta, and two, because I think it became a little bit irrelevant. But from what I have heard, it looked like there was a few things that were kind of, whether it be technical or whatever, that made them make the decision that it was a better process at this stage to put Travis back in the 240. They have the backup car. They've planned for it. He's very familiar with it. And that was the decision that was made. So I believe it was the team, but we could find out.
Okay. I can't wait to talk to Travis Reeder then.
Yeah, me too. So we'll see how it goes. All right. We're really getting into it. Now the top 10 points. Your point number 10, Ryan Turek made it. We're clearly talking about the fact that in Long Beach he had that pretty catastrophic crash to the point where his car was completely wiped out. We talked about how the chassis was already in breakdown mode pretty quickly right after the event, and he made it. He came out with another FT86.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, can you do some cool editing? Can we show the Ryan Turk accident while you're talking?
Oh, my God. If we can, if we can, we won't look ridiculous, and it will be somewhere on the screen here.
Yeah, right here. Can you talk to the editor? I'd like to see it right here.
We're going to try. It's gonna. Okay. We're going to try, yeah.
I'm so glad you have a production team behind this.
We do, absolutely.
You know, I think Ryan Turk got really lucky. I'm sure he wouldn't consider himself really lucky because he took his streetcar and destroyed it to make a second Formula Drift car. I think without that car being, let's say, maybe 50%, I don't think they would have been there. No. So in a sense, I think Turk's lucky and unlucky. He ruined a great car. I think he put a lot of time into, but he also made it to the event. So I'm sure his sponsors consider himself probably pretty lucky. However that works out, but I don't know. There was definitely a time where I feel like just, you know, I haven't spoken to Turk, but like just even watching some of the blackout content, you know, and some of the things that kind of came out between listening to him talk after the race, like I definitely feel like there was a feeling at some point where those guys thought they weren't going to make it. So right. It's really cool that they, you know, got it together. Cause they also, I think there was 3 weeks between the events, but then you've got to consider he's obviously in LA having to get the car to Orlando. So they probably had to leave Monday, I'm going to guess. So, I mean, they really only had about 2 weeks probably. They probably didn't want to do anything a day or two after Long Beach anyway. So, I mean, they probably put almost that whole car together in like 10 days.
Yeah.
So that's like less than 250 hours, not including sleep.
Yeah. And I don't care what you say or how you do it. Even if the car was 60% ready, to get a car ready to be competitive as he needs it to be on this level, that's not a short feat at all.
Yeah, and then, you know, he beat your boy, so.
Which boy?
Travis Rader. Your point 11 in top 32.
Well, I mean, look. So, moving on to point number 9.
Hey.
Jonathan Castro just dominates OSW is your point. You know, listen, I think what's interesting to me is, first off, I really like Jonathan. Just on a personal level. Nothing more. I think he's a super nice guy. I've always had a good conversation with him. But what's interesting is I feel like the tone, and this is obviously like really speculative, but I feel like the tone of his program, I feel like the tone of his driving just feels amplified this year. It feels like he came out of the gate swinging, like he's got something on the table. He's always a good driver, and you know, your point goes on to basically talk about how successful and dominant he's really been at OSW particularly. But listen, I feel like watching him in these first two events, he has a tone that he's out to set.
I think so. Something to note, I think the last time Castro was in my top 10, I think was for Orlando. And we talked about him having recently had a kid. So, like, I think that's probably, you know, compounding distractions, compounding complications. I did notice that a lot of, you know, he's Dominican Republic based, which, you know, to Orlando is pretty local. I mean, I guess you could say, I think it's a sub 2 hour flight or right around 2 hours.
Right.
And so his wife was out there. His kid was out there. I think a lot of his family was out there. So I think he's one of those people who just maybe feels more pressure to perform, you know, with like an audience. And so like, it's kind of a shame that he can't have like a, you know, traveling,
you kind of lose your, you know, this is as close as he'll get to having a home event. This is the home base event of his season right now. So kind of having some of those people there, and maybe it's comfort, maybe it's pressure, however you want to state it. But clearly there may be some underlying impact that is there.
Yeah. And I think some people thrive in those situations and then some people fail in those situations. So.
Right.
It just seems to be that he's clearly like able to, whatever his motivation is, it seems like he's definitely more focused or like really like putting in to his like car control and like really dedicating to his tandem like in Orlando. It seems to me like biggest consistent factor is him and his like mental state or however he's changing there. So, you know, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. He's been a driver that I've loved since he showed up. And I really want him to be able to like move into that next, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting seeing him go up against Gucci though. So
that was a great battle.
It was a great battle.
There's always like top 32 is kind of a snooze fest. We can be honest. I don't think there was one upset in top 32 this year. So that's just kind of an interesting footnote. Comment below if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. top 32 tends to lack some, you know, unless like a guy like Travis Reeder beats Von Gittin Jr. or something like that. There's not a very memorable experience in top 32 with those two guys, man. If you're going to watch one battle from top 32, definitely watch the Gucci Castro battle. Gucci's like car catches on fire. It was a whole thing. It's pretty great.
Yeah. I mean, in two of the same platforms, I mean, if you're going to run them out together, that's one way to do it. Moving on to point number 8, Adam LZ, and your whole thing is hold off on the verdict. I have my own thoughts. I'm going to let you take this one right off the top.
I mean, obviously, we could probably do a whole podcast on the Adam LZ controversies, conspiracies, merits. I don't really care, to be honest. I'll just put that out there. I've seen a lot of people talking about how he's not running a Pro-Am series. He didn't run one. And I would say to those people, number one, Florida doesn't have a Pro-Am series. So, like, he's Pro-Am-less in his region. Number two, if he drove to whatever Pro-Am series he wanted to, Texas, I don't even know what's close to him, Virginia, the Lookout Drift guys, whoever it would be, U.S. Drift, then everyone there would complain that he showed up in a stacker trailer with an S15 and beat up on everyone in Pro-Am.
Right.
So I think in a way he's kind of in a lose-lose situation.
Yeah.
I also think if you really want to do your research before you just talk smack on the internet, which is pretty much nobody, there have been some atrocious drivers to be given Pro 2 provisionals without Pro Am license. Not saying names, but do yourself a favor. Go to the Pro 2 standings, scroll all the way down.
We went there.
And some of those guys way down there also got a Pro 2 provisional, and no one cared because they weren't famous or, you know, YouTube famous or whatever it may be. All that aside, or do you have a comment on that?
No, finish your point and then I'll jump in.
So moving along, this is what I think is interesting. I think twofold. I think if you look at his event, like let's just remove him from being anyone special. If I was analyzing for him, if I was his spotter, if I was working for his team, I would say that I think his first run was pretty acceptable. I mean, your first ever Pro 2 run, he put down an 83 in most other Pro 2 contest, that would have been he had been in the show, wouldn't have had a problem.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know where the issue was. I don't know if Adam didn't listen to his spotter. I know his spotter is pretty good. He's also, you know, he has a lot of experience. Yep. I don't know if the spotter had like a brain fart, wherever it happened, but he like basically went like balls deep for 100 on the second run, which two problems with that. Number one, there's a ton of cars in the grid. And your spotter should be looking, you know, I spotted for a while for a driver that's been on this podcast. And like what you need to be doing in that first qualifying run is you need to be saying, okay, you should be roughly writing down everyone's score. You should be able to go, you're about, you know, 12. Now, if you're not in the top five, I think you should not be
trying for a
100 point run. Exactly. You really shouldn't anyway, in my opinion. I think you'd be far better off trying to back up your 83, maybe push an 85, 87, and put yourself in the show, especially with Pro 2. The qualifying scores aren't as rich. I think the competition isn't as rich. Like in Pro, there's definitely a much more advantage to kind of pushing harder in qualifying.
Right.
But you also got to consider, like, you have an 83. There are other guys with 83. So it's like, hey, man, we need to back this up with a score. Let's get in the show. Let's maybe push it to 85, 87. Seems to me like he went out and did a 100-point run. Now, what's interesting is he, if you cue the clip.
Jeez, stop doing that.
Adam LZ, you can see he currently has an 83 on his first run, which has him into 11th, but a lot of drivers tied. So Adam LZ, massive angle there from LZ. Comes out swinging. Oh, and looks like that will be an incomplete. So he's going to have to rest if on that 83.
I'm just kidding. If you watch his second run, he just kind of – he, like, had too much angle and speed, and he, like, couldn't, like, make it – like, get into the big, like, inner bank, like, turn area.
Yeah.
Now, if he makes that and he gets a 100-point run or a 95-point run, everyone would be saying – you know, heads would explode. It'd be the greatest decision in Formula Drift history to let him in. He didn't make it. He got on the bubble and he went out of the event.
Yeah.
Now, let me wrap. Sorry.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay. So the interesting thing. So now separating that. Now I watched all that happen. I wrote this opinion and then I actually went and watched his vlog, which I find is kind of interesting. He seemed to be like really like, I don't know, like not as bummed out as I thought he would be that he didn't qualify, but I don't know if that was like just for YouTube or whatever. I think if anybody that's listening to this, for our millions and millions of fans on the podcast,
that's right.
If anyone is listening to this, I think if you ever want to become a pro driver, I think even maybe not even in drifting, if you want to like compete in, let's say, even time attack on like a, you know, on a big level, sport compact, drag racing, Formula D, whatever it may be, I think you should watch every minute of his vlog series because I went back in time. I watched about the first 2 weeks before, like he was like prepping his motor, doing testing. They bought the stacker trailer. I kind of like followed the process.
Yeah.
I think it's as someone who's worked on a Formula D team in some capacity for different people over the years. I've been a member of the media in Formula D for 15 plus years. I think that vlog, if he keeps up at that pace, is going to be the best behind the scenes access a normal person is ever going to get to a professional race team in the automotive aftermarket, bar none. And right. I think it's almost timeless. Like, I think you could watch those vlogs in 10 years. If your kid turns 15 and they're like, I want to be a race car driver, be like, watch this. Do you actually want to do this?
Yeah.
You know, like, and that's my thought. I know we kind of got long-winded there, but it's regardless of how you feel about it, I think yeah. you should be watching the vlog. Not that he needs anyone hawking vlog views for him, but
yeah, right. And especially not on this podcast.
Yeah, it was right. It was really cool, man. Like, I'll say I was pretty interested. I think, like I said, if you have any interest on Formula D, I'm assuming by listening to this podcast, you're kind of more of like an inside,
yeah.
you know, person. I, even if Formula Drift was like, we're going to put our film crew with a driver and filmed that driver all week and like compiled the
they
behind.
They would not have captured what he captures.
I agree. And
I agree.
And it's very like, he's very comfortable with the guys filming. He's doing a lot of it himself. So like, I think there's just this very like, I don't know. There's very much like in, regardless of what you feel about him. I
almost
think
like you're fly on the wall type of thing with a little commentary. Yeah,
it's just very authentic because he's a person that's put his life on the internet for so long that this is just like another. It's not like, oh, I need to perform because we're filming. It's like it was just him
yeah.
at a race event. So it's kind of cool.
So I guess now it's my turn to rant. And I think, you know, what's interesting is that I think Adam LZ and where I'm about to go are, I think that they're far more important and significant than we may even be giving them credit for. And I'll explain why. First off, I've heard a lot of people talk about this and complain about this. And I had a lot of people, well, I've heard people talk and complain about this and really hate on this cause. And when I realized who they were or where this was coming from, some of it I was really shocked on. You know, listen, you can feel that, you know, I don't want to say jealous, it's not the right word, but you can feel that, you know, Adam LZ didn't earn his way to this point. You can feel that Adam LZ got in for popularity reasons from his YouTube following. You can feel all the thoughts that you want to feel. But at the end of the day, let's go back to this petition thing. Adam LZ has proven, whether it be through his videos, through his other competitions, and through some of the different people in the drift community, that he knows how to proficiently drift and tandem and all the aspects that you would need to be able to make a petition. That's the first thing. The second thing is he clearly has the funding that he's pulled together, whether it's because he makes all this YouTube money or whether it's because he has a business or whether because, you know, he figured out how to crack the thing and get funding. It doesn't matter. The point is he has the funding. He showed that. And then the third is he has a very competent vehicle that's capable for Pro 2 competition. If you put all these things together, I think that they're, like you said before, I think that he his position and his skill level and the things he brings to the program, I believe, are well within line for being issued that provisional. So I really think that that's kind of a BS thing. And for people that really are still offended by that whole thing, I think it's more of a self issue or because you're just looking for somebody to troll on, right?
I agree.
Do I know Adam LZ in some capacity? Yeah, but like we're not like super good friends. I don't go text him at, you know what I mean? Like enough that I can say hello to him amicably and you know, and we have some communication, but not like I don't email him every day. You know what I mean? Like there's nothing there. I'm not biased in that sense. I don't sponsor him. He's sponsored by another wheel company. Like it's not, I have no ties there. So there's no reason for this, right? Like I don't have any bias in that respect. The second piece is I really think people need to take a step back. When you get somebody like into this sport, is there a bigger consideration? I think this may be, you know, you will hear a lot of talk about this where people said things about Formula Drift as an organization, letting him in because he's got the YouTube following. And I want to make a little comment on it, which is sometimes we have to look at things for the greater good. And Adam LZ, and I don't care what position you are, whether you want to consider it YouTube or not, I believe Adam LZ is good for the sport of drifting. And I think it's especially good for Formula Drift as a series. You can disagree with me. It's my own personal opinion. And I think that his bringing vision and eyeballs, and yes, his YouTube eyeballs, to this event, I think is a great thing. And anything that enhances and uplifts our sport, whether it be now or in the future, or whether this continues to happen and we see other drivers that, you know, are there's a lot of drift guys that are drifting that have YouTube channels, have popularity, whatever it is. If they segue in this way, is that a good thing? It really could be. Because let's not forget that guys like Vaughn Gittin Jr., they brought main sponsors and mainstream media attention to Formula Drift, and you would argue that that was a really good thing for the sport. And I think that YouTube and stuff like that coming to the sport, you know, from Adam's following, I think is a great thing. And the one thing I will point out in addition to that is that Pro 2, if you've ever been to a Pro 2 event and you've walked around the paddock, you've walked around some of the different cars, listen, these are guys with 10x10 tents and their trucks parked next to the tents and they're in there thrashing away. And you don't see a ton of like fans hanging out in the Pro 2 area. Now, listen, I'm not making shots. We love Pro 2. We Koenig heavily supports drivers in Pro 2 because we do our best to help these guys out because it's a very costly thing for them to do and there's not a lot of support in the Pro 2 area. So I mean that with no disrespect.
Oh, I thought it was required that you run Koenig wheels to be in Pro 2.
I mean, I like the way it sounds, but no, it's not. So listen, I mean, I just think that, like, you know, we love our Pro 2 drivers and we give them the utmost respect, but Adam LZ, if you were able to see what his area looked like between, you know, between runs, even when he wasn't running, their paddock was jammed. I mean, they had people line up 30 minutes before they knew he would be able to take pictures, and they had lines wrapped around the area. I mean, going really far off. The fact that fans are willing to go to in the Pro 2 part of it and wait to have autographs and things like that, I think it's a good thing. And I don't care what anybody says, you bring attention to the sport. It's a really positive thing. Adam LZ did it. I give a lot of kudos to his team. I think with all eyeballs on them and with all the different kind of things and people and hating and all the things that was out there, I think Adam and his team handled themselves with grace, and they did a very good job at being as professional as possible. So listen, I know I ranted for a little bit. I apologize for anybody who is listening to that long-winded, you know, dissertation on Adam LZ. But, you know, listen, I do feel pretty adamant about it. I think that if you really do care about the sport, you have to take a step back and really think about that. And, you know, in regards to his secondary run there, where he had that, you know, that faux pas, listen, I think he really went for it. I don't know that there was any, you know, whether he was really going for 100 or not, or he was just trying to make sure he was in the show. Maybe he had some overconfidence issue. Maybe he just choked. I mean, there could be a whole reasons. I know what he said in his own vlog there, but, you know, the truth is, I think if you step back on his first Pro 2 competition on that level, I think they handled themselves excellent.
For sure.
Moving on to point number 7. Chelsea Denofa's chase and speed were mind-blowing. Man, it seems like the Mustangs are really fast this year, and Chelsea is certainly leading that pack.
Yeah, Chelsea had some great follow tandems. He always does. I bring this up in the Von Gittin Jr. point as well, but these cars have some insane speed while in drift. And I think it could really help them in Atlanta.
Right. That makes sense, right? That's where we see it the most. So is that it? Is that what you think?
That's it.
All right, good. So moving on to point number 6, Trent Beecham runs a perfect Pro 2 weekend. What's interesting about Trenton, is, again, another Mustang, right?
That is correct.
Okay, good. I was just looking for affirmation. So so there's that. What's interesting to me, and we just kind of briefly spoke about this right before we got on, which was that he qualified. We know that last year he finished 16th. Was that the call? Was that what we were looking for?
That's correct.
But then you pulled up some interesting stuff really right in between that made me go, oh, you want to lead on what that was?
Yeah, so I actually think what I told you before was wrong. But
oh, good. So
basically, Trenton, we're not sure if he ran in St. Louis, but he basically qualified one out in Atlanta and then basically was like top four in Long Beach and in Texas. So, you know, even if you would have considered he would have got, I think, top 8 in St. Louis, that have pushed him in well into the top 10. So you look at a lot of the guys that finished in the top 5 and a lot of them aren't back. So I think, you know, if I was a betting man, I think I'd be putting my money on Beecham to win this thing because nobody really looked like they were going to beat him this weekend. If we're being honest.
Right.
And I mean, a rookie finished 2nd, a rookie.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Man,
I mean, look, we've seen the rookie thing could happen, right? We have a Travis Reeder.
Okay, but this is a real rookie, not a Daigo Saito rookie.
All right. I'm just saying. All right, but yes, I understand what you mean. He's definitely one to watch, and I guess we're gonna see coming up here, you know, real soon. See where that leads him. Moving on to point number 5. I think if you know, I know Pat a little bit, not well, but I think we all kind of feel this way, which is number 5, you wanted just a little bit more from Pat Gooden on his home turf. He's an OSW. He runs OSW events down there. It's more than his home turf. It's not like the place where that's closest to him. He really spends a lot of time there. So I guess we were thinking that coming in, this might have been a really good track to see him do some work at, right?
Yeah, I think just take everything I said about Jonathan Castro and make it the opposite.
Oh, jeez. Well.
Well, I mean, kind of.
I know what you mean.
I mean, if you look back in history, like, he historically doesn't do well at Orlando. And then what I find interesting is his best career finish of all time is in Seattle, which OSW is really just a mini Seattle. So, like, his best career finish was 4th place in Seattle. And like by him doing good in Seattle and bad in Orlando tells me, I think he has the opposite reaction as Castro, where like, I think for whatever reason, being on his home track, either he's too comfortable, too distracted. He just can't perform at the highest level. But I think another interesting thing to make where we don't beat up on Pat is Adam LZ's. Oh, is it these OSW events failed to qualify? Kelsey Rowlings of Kona Wheels fame, also is her local track, and she failed, you know, to perform very well. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't know. Maybe there's something to that. I would imagine at OSW during these events, they're running the FD course. So, like, why can all of these, like, Florida locals not put it together on their home track? That's kind of a, I don't know, something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, Kelsey found the wall a little bit too quick. I mean, there was obviously some steering malfunction there, which is kind of disappointing because, you know, I really would like to see her, you know, kind of get through that. They've been struggling with this power steering issue just for, I mean, it feels like a million years now. I'm not sure what the remedy is. I haven't really spoken to them or, you know, or Dan. But, you know, I really hope that they get it sorted out or get some help for it, because the truth is it's really taking down her chance at, you know, kind of advancing through.
I got a great solution for her.
I'm afraid to ask, but I would like to hear it, maybe.
Put an LS engine in your car.
All right, but we're moving on right now. I don't... all right.
Am I wrong?
I don't know that I think it's this engine. Do you think? From what I understand... Well,
I don't...
Go ahead.
Listen, I don't know if I know it's the engine, but this is what I do know. This is what I tell everybody in professional racing. There's only one type of person in racing that can do something creative and inventive, and it's well-funded race programs, right? Frederick Oswo could put a moped engine in his car, and they will figure it out.
Yeah.
Because Steph Papadakis has got money falling from... You know, there's like a direct, like, you know, those like bank chutes. I think there's one that they built to go from Toyota headquarters in Plano all the way to Papadakis Racing in Hawthorne. I think just money is constantly.
I mean,
like
we're not going to discredit all the skill that Stefan has, right?
No, I'm not discrediting. Absolutely not. I think.
Just want to make sure we're clear with that.
I mean, no, I think he's, I mean, if you go watch I think the Hoonigan video talking about his drag car was one of the coolest things I watched in a long time. No one is disputing his credentials, but what I'm saying is I don't care if you put, you know, one of the best mechanics on that program. They don't have a lot of money. It's a grassroots budget team. To me, the best way to hack a grassroots budget team is to do what everybody else has done, and that way you can figure out the problem. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yep.
There's just – how many LSs are in 240SXs?
Yeah.
Thousands?
Yep.
Hey, you have this weird issue. You start asking all these other thousand guys, and someone goes, oh, yeah, I have this problem. Do this to this. Boom. Problem no longer. How many Coyote motors are in 240s? Three? And that might even be high. I mean, we know of one.
Right.
So that's just the thing is it's like, you know, there's this, you know, could Kelsey be successful in a Toyota Corolla? Probably not.
Right.
But like, under the Papadakis program, there you go. Like that's all I'm trying to say is like with money and, you know, smart race car mechanics, you can do anything you want.
Right.
You know, I'm sure they could get out there. I mean, you know, in a UPS truck and probably be competitive if it was, right. It was allowed in the rule book, but it's like when you're a lower funded team, I think it behooves you to be like, you know, I'm going to bring out a Mustang with a Mustang engine, or I'm going to be in a Corvette, or I'm going to do a 240 with an LS swap, like something that just has a lot of data points and a lot of background to help your program. Because once again, you say they have this power steering issue. They can't seem to figure it out. I sure as hell don't know how to help them figure it out, but they're in this weird situation where like they have this motor that no one has in their car. And like generally that's never really been successful. I mean, if you look at, you know, there was a guy, I forget his name. They had that they were like the first ones to put that weird Nissan engine in I think they had a VQ38 in like a 240. Mm. It's the same kind of thing. Like it worked sometimes, it didn't. But then like, you know, how do you overcome these, you know, obstacles? I think if you were maybe like you have Forsberg, who, you know, has now put a GTR motor in his car after years of the VQ56. But like, He does have a little bit of support from Nissan, I think some product support and whatnot. But he also knows Nissan's. He knows that Z.
Yeah.
He has a team of guys that have worked on it. So, like, I don't know. That, you know, it's very cool to be different, but, like, I think you should make your difference in, like, your wrap, your wheels, like, some aesthetics, you know, make right. it look really good. And then just, you know, mechanically, like, look, put a 2J in your 240. Put a 2J in your RX-7. Put a, you know, I mean – With help from Sicky and these other companies, I mean, I basically, with the help of a few people, because wiring and stuff's not my strong suit, like I put an LS in a 240.
Right.
And I have no skills whatsoever. But you know what I mean? Like with the Sicky kit and a few things, and it's kind of like boom, boom, boom. And then I got nowhere near the wiring. But
I understand.
Case in point, like you could pretty much do that swap in your home garage.
Well, I mean, for the most part, they do most of their work in their home garage, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
We've hung up on this. That was my, you know, rant of the day. But we can move along to point number four here.
You are entitled.
Didn't see that coming. Yeah. It was bad. I mean, if you just look at the thumbnail on formulad.com of the photo I have, it's like Vaughn's wheel is completely out of the fender. I mean, I think the car is just pretty much sitting on the, you know, on the body, on the ground. I mean, this crash was so bad it held up the start of top 32 because they couldn't get the car off the track. And then what's crazy is he was the second battle. So, like, by the time they got that car off the track and put it down on the tow truck, I imagine, I don't know, you could probably time it, but there's no way they had more than 30 minutes to fix this thing. I'd guess on ballpark of 20. And if you look at my notes, they swapped every corner of the suspension. They put all new wheels and tires in the car, and they even did somewhat of like an alignment and adjusted the toe. That's crazy. I couldn't do one side of my suspension in an hour. Yeah, they didn't like flip a coil over in there. Yeah, they put everything. I would imagine they had to do a lot in the front. I actually think they have boards. It's like front left, and it's like every yeah. So okay, I haven't watched any of his content. Maybe I need to add that to my list. It's pretty rad. I'll straight the car. pretty incredible. I don't really have anything to say. So I'll say this. I mean, they were working on the car before Top 16. He, for some reason, tried to impede Chris Forsberg. I just misjudged how fast Forsberg was. Blew it. Two things right there within 10 seconds that I've never seen with that team. Working, wrenching on a car. And after two rounds, James is 119 points behind Odie Bautista. If he wins, if he qualifies first in Atlanta and wins, and Odie goes, doesn't even qualify, he's still not in first place. That's crazy. Not even to mention some guys between him and Odie would get points and he would still be, you know, I imagine the best he could do if he qualified first and won Atlanta is probably be 80 points behind the champion. Which, man, whew. I think the interesting stat that I kind of dug up was pretty easy, but for you lazy folks, after two rounds last year, he had scored 69 more points than he has now. And when you think about, let me do some quick on the fly math for you, some podcast exclusives, and then we'll move on here. 20, what are you in your head for? I should have added this into my article, but I didn't. So here's an interesting stat. Let's do this number. You're watching math happen on the fly with a computer. Oh, that's high. Okay, nailed it. Second try. If you look at how many points he qualified to win the championship last year, it was 595. The gap in what he's missing, those 69 points, is basically 11.5% of the total points he won the championship with. You following that? Like he's already missing 12, like almost 12% of what he needed to get that championship. I think the interesting though point I will say is if you deduct those 69 points from his last year's championship, he'd still finish second pretty comfortably. He'd still be like almost 25 points ahead of his Wardhouse teammate. Then he'd be, you know, he'd be over 100 points ahead of Forsberg. So it's interesting, man. But like, oof, if he can't pull off a top four in Road Atlanta, if he can't pull himself like into the top 10, top eight after Atlanta, I think it's I think we pretty much have a new champion in 2019. It's just going to be a matter of who is that new champion. I don't think so. I disagree. Let's put it this way. Cue the video. Cue the video.
Sure. Osbo style. That four-cylinder turbo nitrous setup under the hood. Frederick Osbo with a 98 on his first run. And a 99 on his second run. Ryan, minimal corrections, if at all. So, Odie Force, look at that, a 99 from Daijiro Yoshihara.
This is why you're wrong. I do think, listen, I'm very frustrated. I think there would be, I do think the 100 score should be there. I think one of those two guys, I think, could have easily gotten it. This is what I'll say real quick. This is why I think you're wrong. Watch those two 99 scores and tell me on the next podcast or wherever you want. You can text me. You can post it on your Facebook page. The whole world wants to know, where are you deducting those other 4 points? Because you can't. They're not there. Because no one can drive perfectly. Well, here's one of the big issues, I think. I think if you look, if you had one of the Formula Drift judges on this podcast, which if you'd like to, I'm sure we could figure something out. And you had them watch that Tanner Faust qualifying clip, which I've been desperately looking for. Can't find it. If they watched it, maybe we could work with the Formula Drift media team and come up with this clip. I don't think that run would have been an 85 by today's judging standards. Sure. I think it was 100 for the time. I think it was 100 for the time. I think the capability of the drivers, I was there. I was like standing on the entry wall when he did that lap. And I remember I was like, wow. Like the lap got me. Like I was like, wow. Like I was like taking photos. And like as he came by, I was like, did I just watch that? Like that was crazy. Because especially back then, there were guys that were in tandem competition who couldn't even really link the course. So for him to come out there and like, I would say it was like a 2016, 2017 level Formula Drift lap. And I don't even know when that was, maybe 2011, 2010. I think for the ability of what Formula Drift was in that year, I think it was 100. I think the problem is 100 in 2011 or whatever that lap was, 2010, is now it's like 85. I mean, that's the difference. I mean, go watch a 2004 Formula D tandem battle on YouTube, and that would be two incomplete runs. The cars are like literally so far apart, it's like not even considered tandem. So, listen, it's there. I'm frustrated. I agree. I want to see the 100-point run. I almost think it's like being done intentionally a little bit, if you want my tinfoil hat on. But I agree. I'm hearing a lot of this feedback that like, look, like the qualifying is becoming inflated. And I genuinely think back in the day, D1 used to do that. It was like 100, you know, 99, 99, 99, 99, 99, 98, 98.8. Like, it's kind of lame. I think if this continues, I think Formula Drift is going to have to change their format. And I don't know how easy that's going to be. But I'm a huge hater of qualifying in general. I'll say this and we can talk about Odie. I think what they're going to have to do, this is the problem with what you said about this whole, he should get a 95. This is how you fix that. Right? Well, that's what you were saying. You know, was it a 95? Right now, when you pull up to the line, every driver has a 100-point run. Okay? So, like, as you drive, all you're doing is decreasing your score opportunity, right? So you enter past the last cone. Okay, now you're at, like, a 70, right? Like, whatever the judge is. Each judge is watching a different format. What I think would be interesting is I think the maximum score a driver should be able to get is maybe, say, a 60. And so that, you know, let's say 20 points for line, 20 points for angle, 20 points for, you know, whatever, going through that whole thing. And then I think there should be this additional pie, maybe 40 points is too big, maybe do 25 points, where, like, we're rewarding, like, true excitement. Because there's a big difference between, you know, Long Beach is a great example. There's a big difference between a Forrest Wang 96 and a Frederick Osbo 96. You know what I mean? Like, Osbo's taking the more conservative line, Forrest Wang smacking the, you know, wall, ripping off his bumper. Like, I think what they need to do is a perfect score should be a score that would get you into the show, but it's like drifting also should have this impact value, this entertainment value. And I understand people are going to say, well, there's a score for impact, but it's like, or like, you know, style, but it's like, I mean, okay, like if style really counts, like there's a couple drivers who will remain nameless that should never have points for it, but they do. So it's like, to me, I think you need to restructure it where you gain all these points. So like you could have a perfect run, but like if you're like off the wall, you're not really flicking really hard, there's a ceiling. There's only a certain level you can get, you know. But like if you're willing to like rip your bumper and taillight off, because it's high risk, high reward, right? Like those guys are like a fifth of an inch away, a mistake from total. So to me, I think that needs to be rewarded higher than an Odibachi's like qualifying run, where like I think he does all of the things technically that you're supposed to do to get a high score, but he does it in a box. If you know what I mean, like I don't want to take away from what he's doing. I think he's a great driver, but he doesn't have that Forrest Wang, Alec Honnadel like flair. And those guys are taking an extreme risk. Denofa's another one. And I don't think they're getting the fair like reward for it. So like if these high scores continue, I think in my opinion, that's the way to kind of bring things back down, like somewhat of a reset for the series. Anyone that wants to watch non-subjective auto racing is welcome to tune in to every other effing racing series on the planet. Like, I don't know if that's considered. I don't think that is considered racing in any real like way. Listen, I don't know. I'm not even going there. I'm not going to upset the millions of Monster Jam fans on the millions of people listening to this podcast. I don't understand. Listen, if you want to take out the subjectiveness of drifting, then road race. Put yourself to sleep every weekend. There's a reason. It's not shots fired. There's a reason. Formula Drift has, you know, 3 million followers on Facebook, and Indy probably has like 200,000. You know, like it's exciting, it's consumable. If you can't let go, to me, what I've found is that I actually really enjoy the human element of drifting. I think that I just really gravitate towards like judged sports, and I am a big soccer fan, which obviously has rules and things, but I don't know. Like, I think the human nature, the human element of judging is great. It's not going to change. It's not going to go away. And so to me, I actually think what you would find with my version of qualifying is I think you'd find less annoyed fanboys on the internet, which not that we really care about them, but what I do think that I'm proposing is actually a way that I think, listen, most people watching Formula D don't understand line. They don't understand angle. I mean, they do, but they don't. Like, if someone's watching a Frederick Osmo and a Forrest Wang, you know, you mirror those runs. Forrest Wang smashes his bumper and taillight right on the Long Beach wall, and Frederick Osmo comes within an inch of it. Well, technically, they were both on the line, so, like, they both get the same score, right? They both did the same thing. Forrest Wang just did it in a much more aggressive way, but that's my point. That's not rewarded. So like if you were to go man on the street this thing outside the Conan office and show people both those battle, these made up qualifying runs, and be like, hey, who do you think won this event based on this? Well, they're gonna all pick Forrest Wang because it just looks like it's another peg above. So you know, I don't know. It's like it's you know, I understand, like, in Formula One, you can pass somebody, and whether you pass somebody on the brakes sideways, you know what I mean? Like, and you know, zip by, It's still a pass. A pass is a pass. The thing is, it's like, you know, that's not what drifting should be, I don't think. I think that there's an entertainment factor. There's a subjective factor. And so that's all I'm saying. If you're one of those people that wants to get subjectiveness out of drifting, I think you should just get out of drifting. Yeah. Maybe. I mean, on the last podcast, I kind of proposed this cockamamie theory. And I was like, hey, like, his wife used to be a spotter. She just had a kid. He wins Long Beach with this other spotter. What if he wins Orlando? And he wins Orlando. I mean, I didn't think he couldn't not win Orlando. I just think the probability was really small. I imagine with Atlanta being so close and Jersey also being really close, his wife probably doesn't want to be back in the spotter stand anyway. So what if he wins Atlanta? it's interesting. To me, I think at this point, you win two events. I think you just say, I think it's Jonathan Bradford, J Brad. Most people know him as. I think you just say, hey, man, it's you. You're the guy. Like, but, you know, I don't know. I'm not part of the team. That's what I would do. Another interesting footnote that I added in on formulado.com is the last time a driver won Long Beach and Atlanta, which those were the two first rounds back then. They were also in Falcon Tire. His name was Justin Pollock, and he finished fourth in the championship that year. So, you know, Odie's got a long road ahead. If you look at, you know, James Dean won with 595 points. I think he's collected just over, he's got to be over 200, obviously, from qualifying. But, like, he needs 400 points, basically, let's just say, from the next six rounds. Still, and I mean, you divide that up, that's 67 points a round off the top of my head, 66, 65. So, I mean, he basically still needs, I mean, a bunch of podiums, you know? It's interesting when you start messing with the numbers like that, you're like, oh man, you know, 200 points sounds like a lot after two rounds, but it's like, if you need 600 to win, and you've got to think Dean only won the championship by 5 points. So, like, you've got to think someone should be close to that unless we start mixing up the podium a lot. But to me, if you're a team and you're trying to win a championship, I think you look at last year's points and say, we need this many points. Like, how do we get 600 points? So short of him winning the next four rounds, which would be really damn interesting, I think he's got a lot of work to do. I think he's got a road ahead. And I think the other downside to you winning two rounds in a row is you've got everybody's attention now. Like, every other driver's like, okay, we got, you know, turn up that, you know, turn up the boost, switch the nitrous shot to a 175 or 150, you know, whatever these guys are doing. I think if he finishes second or third, he could maybe slide under the radar for a little bit, but it's like, dude, you win the first two events of the year, guys are, you know, I think they're going to start treating him like they treat a battle against Dean, Osbo, and Forsberg, right? Like, I think when you see guys run those guys, most other drivers are much more likely to make a mistake, I think, especially the more amateur drivers, because they're like, this is it, you know, I got to get my guy. And you'll see a lot of times when people battle James Dean, James isn't even really beating them a lot of the times. They're just choking themselves, right? They're spinning, they're hitting James, whatever the case may be. So, yeah, and I think Odie now has the target on his back, which I don't think he's really had before. He has been a championship leader in the past, but I don't know. Well, he's won events. He's never won a championship, right? But I'm saying he's been a leader of the championship, but to me, you come out of the championship, you win two events, everyone is looking at you in the paddock a little bit differently. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, what's this guy got going on? I agree. It'll be cool. And I'll be in Atlanta next week. So I will definitely not be in New Jersey. So I hate New Jersey. If you want to see me, come by, say hello. In Atlanta. Hope that you're looking for me. You can hang out with Scott and get exclusive behind the wheel merch. There you go. Hey, man. The hustle's real. Can't wait. Atlanta's probably going to be a little delayed, to be honest. It's going to be a tough one to squeeze in. Because I got a Hyperfest the weekend after. So we might be like the next week after Atlanta. Because Hyperfest week's a little bit of a crazy one. I know. I understand. I understand. I just don't want to disappoint the millions of listeners. Yeah, that's a great idea, actually. Where you can find me is on the Hyperfest Instagram page, at Hyperfest. I'm pretty much running that till the event. I'll be posting there, and I'll be at the event. You can come say hi. Some other great Formula D drivers are going to be there. Dirk Stratton, Von Gittin Jr., Chelsea Denofa, myself. There's some other drivers. Adam LZ will be there. Kelsey Rawlings was scheduled to be there, but I don't know with her car crash if they're going to – I don't know her situation at the moment. But if you don't like drifting, I have no idea why the hell you listen to this whole podcast, but they've got rally racing. They've got road racing. It's pretty cool, man. It's pretty cool. I'm going to boldly go out on a claim and say that it is the most diverse – automotive event in America. You can camp out, and then the burnout. Listen, if you do go, you got to go to the burnout contest. A, who doesn't love a burnout contest? And B, it gets kind of crazy, man. It's pretty fun. They box everybody off, but I think the cool thing is the burnout box is actually like kind of underground. I forget what they call it. They do some kind of weird like circle racing with it. So you've got the track, which they use as the median. And then all the fans, you get like a good probably like 1,000, 2,000 people that just stand at the edge of the track. And then you have like an inside K-railed area for the burnout. So it's kind of cool. So like the fans are probably like 10, 15 feet above the cars doing burnouts. So everyone kind of has like a good view, and you can – whatever you want to do in the K-rail, some guys like slam their car against the K-rail. Some guys try and do donuts. Some guys' cars don't even run. I've seen a like F – 350 on like 40s do a burnout, which is probably the most expensive burnout I'll ever see in my life. But it's fun, man. It's a run what you brung. Yeah, exactly. You can camp. You buy one weekend ticket. There's even some music going on. It's pretty cool, man. You know, I'm just the guy running the Instagram page, but I'll tell you, I'm going to be there. It's going to be a blast. Be prepared to drink a lot of beer if that's your thing. And yeah, man, just have a great time.